Hello and welcome to the Psychedelic Christian Podcast, the conversation at the crossroads of faith and psychedelics. I'm Clint, your host, and I'm thankful and excited that you've chosen to join us. Enjoy the show. Welcome to episode 28 of the Psychedelic Christian Podcast. Thanks and blessings to you all for joining us today. As usual, I have a great conversation for you and introduce you to yet another traveler I have met here at the intersection of Christian faith and psychedelics. A few brief comments before I introduce you to today's guest. First, thanks to all of you who follow, share, and donate to the show. Your friendship and support is greatly appreciated. Second, I'm keeping this intro short so we can jump right into the conversation. So hang around for the closing segment of the podcast, where I will share another podcast recommendation with you. I will also be sharing with you a University of Pittsburgh research study that you have an opportunity to participate in. Here is your chance to participate in psychedelic history, friends. Check it out. I will have links to the study in the show notes. And in the next episode of the podcast, I will introduce you to one of the study administrators. Finally, I just wanted to mention that this interview is a little shorter than most. My guest had a small family emergency to attend to afterwards, but instead of canceling, he suggested that we just start a little early and move quickly to ensure that we finish up before he has to attend to his family matters. On behalf of myself and you all, I certainly appreciated Alan maintaining our appointment, although it would probably have been easier for him to reschedule. Worry not, however. Alan and I are already making plans to speak again soon on his own podcast, Cost of Doing Nothing. With that, let me introduce you to Alan Wiederhold. Alan is a United States military veteran, a visionary, and a voice of healing. Alan is a survivor and a pioneer who's lived several lifetimes in one. With a 30-year career in healthcare and the U.S. Navy, Alan's life is a testament to resilience and transformation. He's not only an ultra-runner who tests the limits of human endurance, but also a skilled pilot. And he is host of the excellent podcast, Cost of Doing Nothing, where he explores profound questions about freedom and the pursuit of a meaningful life. Alan is a thought leader and a spiritual and emotional guide who integrates the four critical domains of life: physical health, spiritual connection, social bonds, and professional success into a harmonious whole. Through his work in healthcare and facilitation, Alan is committed to helping others discover what it truly means to live freely and fully, proving every day that the key to life is not just surviving, but thriving. Alan Wiederhold, welcome to the Psychedelic Christian Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Clint. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, Alan, you know, we met on LinkedIn recently, and I took the opportunity to listen through your podcast catalog. I think I've listened to most of them, and you've had a pretty profound journey over the last couple of years, and I hope you would share that with my listeners today. But let's start from the beginning. Tell us a little bit about your origin story. You know, what was your early childhood like, your family, and particularly What kind of spiritual influence or church experience or things like that did you encounter in your youth?
Wow. So I'm 54. So Christianity in the 70s and the 80s, we all know what that was. So it's interesting. I came from a large Hispanic family. So my mom was Mexican, my dad is German. It was an amazing family. Like, we got together every Sunday before Mass. I'd spend the night at my grandparents. I was the oldest grandson. The memories that I had of my grandfather were just amazing. So rolling tortillas, listening to Casey Kasem's Top 40, going to Mass, and then just kind of going through the motions of what Mass was. And then around the age of 9, my mom and dad discovered Christianity. They had discovered God, and they gave their lives to Jesus. And they left the Catholic Church. It was a really big no-no for Hispanic people. We just didn't do that. So we went to a church called the People's Church. And I remember not even understanding what all of that was, that my grandparents were calling it the People's Temple. They were Jim Jones. And I didn't really know what any of that was at the time. But we had kind of gone into this. I like to say I was drugged. If there was a church in a or a tent revival in a 25 square mile radius of where we lived, I was drugged there. So that was kind of the experience I grew up with. My parents were amazing. They're still married today at 55 years. And my dad was an elder in the church. But it was also an interesting time because it was a very toxic Christian environment. The guy that I was raised with was sin. Everything was about going to hell or escaping or accepting Jesus for more like fire insurance than it really was actually having a relationship. Well, along that time, I was around the age of 5, I was molested. I was molested for 2 years by a family member. I never told anyone. I just internalized it, got to high school. I'm now trying to figure out this God who's all about sin. I'm being bullied massively because I am Mexican. I can't really grow hair like everyone. I was a late bloomer. So they called me gay. I was a fag. And I questioned my own sexuality forever because I wondered how that could have happened to me that young. Did they see something in me that maybe I didn't know was there? I liked girls, or I thought I liked girls. So there was always this question for me of what it all meant. So, you know, I, despite all of that, graduated high school. I had a lot of depression. I had a lot of conversations and thoughts of suicide, and I would journal some teenage angst, some just really trying to find my own identity in a God that just didn't seem to really be there except to make sure that I didn't screw up. And that was it. So my family moves to from Grand Rapids, Michigan to Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad are going to Bible college at Christ for the Nations. I'm even further into the hole. And I just didn't understand that God. We used to joke and call it the Holy Seance. We would go, and it was more like I equated it to like a church auction. Like you go in and God's going to raise some money, and you'd sit in this auditorium until they raised it. And it, as a teenager, it was just kind of wild. So, you know, I talk about my grandfather and I talk about how close I was. Well, when we moved, that ripped my heart. But what was even worse about that is that my grandfather died when I was 15. He was 66 years old. I died of a liver condition that we later found out, like just this year, what it was. But I blame my parents for so many things, yet I never told anyone about this. So now I'm going the other direction, and I'm Slick Willy, and I'm trying to talk to all these girls and prove that I wasn't gay by really, you know, going that direction and having a lot of body count. Nothing.
So did you have the same experience, like the kind of the bullying and the hazing when you moved to Dallas?
I did, except that now I'm in a Christian school, so it's a little easier to hide. You just have to say a couple of Jesus praises and amens, and you're good. Like, as long as you speak the Christian lingo. Right. So my grandfather passed away. My mom wanted to be near her mom. So we moved back to Michigan. I was just graduating from high school. I was 17. I was always on the outside looking in. It's just kind of how I felt. But for whatever reason, I decided to go to Bible college, the same one that my parents went to. And I was just trying to find my identity. I was trying to find out who I was. God was kind of always around. We were always in church. But it wasn't my God. So I went to the same school. I don't know why, but I went, and I ended up like walking out after a year and a half. I'm like, I can't subscribe to this God. And when I did, I left God. Like, I just was completely, you know what? I have invested enough in the bank of God that I'm done. Like, I can spend the rest of my life never going to church again, and I have enough deposited. That was the mindset. So I went to the military. I spent 4 years on active. I spent 8 in the reserves. That entire time I'm searching. I'm now out of active duty, and I go to college, and I met this incredible, beautiful girl my senior year. And the day I asked her to move into my fraternity house, she never left. We have been together for 26 years. And man, what a ride. I mean, you've listened to some of my show. Trying to find your identity is a very hard thing to do when you don't really have a frame of reference. So I did what I don't know anybody else would do. I hit myself into work. And I worked all the time. So I went to work in healthcare as a healthcare administrator. I was the best in my field. I became very successful at a very young age, which the more success that you feed, the more narcissistic you become, the more you push everyone else away. And then you now become more important to yourself than anyone or anything. So,
and it's a very convenient like metric for measuring your progress in your career. Yeah. That's something you can really identify with, and culture incentivizes that. Because anytime you go to the church, to the country club, to the PTA meeting, the first thing someone asks you is, what do you do? And then you can just list your career accomplishments, you know, and that, for better or worse, we just identify people with their career. And I think that's, I mean, that's certainly an aspect of who we are, but I think it really cheapens our relationships, because we often, if I'm say a school administrator, and you say, well, I'm a plumber, a lot of times the conversation just kind of ends right there.
Yes.
You're like, oh, you're not part of my group. I'll go talk to somebody else. And it's like, we don't get to down to the deeper core of who this other human being is.
You know, what's so crazy about that is even the word Christian, it was a very derogatory term in the very early church. So it was not meant to be what it is today, which is kind of ironic that we have what it is now, the term Christian. Yeah, you know, I was actually listening to John Mark Comer this morning, following the way, and he says, you know, 68% of people identify with Christianity. That number is dropping very seriously. But very few would use the term disciple, because that's actually what we are supposed to be. We're supposed to be disciples of Jesus, not Christians. So Christian is only used two times in the Bible. So that identity of following the rabbi is literally leaving your identity, leaving everything that you know. So it's a very crazy concept when you understand biblical history and you understand Christianity as a whole. So now I'm like, you know, I'm this wildly successful guy. My wife and I built our dream house in Michigan, and the company that I worked for, Principal Financial Group, says, congratulations, you're so good, you now get to move. We look at each other, we're kind of like, okay, well, during this time, I had a son in the military that I never told anyone about. Like, I had these two separate lives. I had this picture-perfect Allen guy who on the inside is just like, I'm dying, I'm struggling. I have this kid who lives with his mom in Texas who hates me because I wouldn't marry her, and I'd pick him up for summer visits. And it was just a really bad situation, but no one ever knew about him. Like, it was just like these, and I used to say, two separate lives, like my work life, my picture perfect thing. And then I got this thing over here. So I picked him up for a summer visit when he was five. My wife and I were just getting ready to get married after college. And she says, I don't want him anymore. You can have him. So all these years of fighting in the courts and trying to be the dad and all this other stuff, he came to live with us, but he had been molested. So I didn't know what to do with that. So I hid behind work. So I, again, am building this massive life and I'm dying. So now they say, let's go. You can go anywhere you want to go. And I go to the East Coast, and I'm like, okay. So I came to Baltimore. I was here for a meeting in the Inner Harbor. And I'm like, this looks cool. Let's move here. And we did. And that's when everything started to fall apart. I worked all the time. I was in the biggest conference rooms in New York City and things were great, but my home life sucked. We were empty. We had everything, but had nothing. My son got into drugs. When he needed a dad, I wasn't there. We called the police. We had him arrested. He served time in Baltimore City Jail, and he stole everything that my wife ever had, every ring, every, you name it. So now he is in jail. He discovers God in the middle of all of this. It's funny because I think Dallas Willard says, God's address is at the end of your rope. It's always where God is found. It's kind of crazy.
Almost always.
It's insane. So he finds God. We're not yet optimistic. So we've heard all this before. So we decide to put him into Teen Challenge. We sent him to YWAM. I sent him to the same Bible college I hated because I couldn't let him move into my home. So it wasn't like I was super excited about his path of God. I just didn't want him around because I just didn't know where he was. So by this time we're having a new family. I have a little girl. She's now one, and he's met her a couple of times, but not really. And then we had a little boy, which to him was a question of where do I fit in? Where's my birthright in all this? So, and he was angry. He was angry for a long time, and he deserved to be. So, but I wasn't there yet. So, you know, we keep building, we keep growing. And I start a company with a friend, and we grew it, and things were amazing. But my life, my marriage still wasn't working. Like, it just wasn't. And I remember there was a point, in our last house, there was a dishwasher. My wife was putting stuff away in the cabinet, and I was standing on the other side of it. That might as well have been the Grand Canyon. We were that far apart. I wanted so badly to tell her how important she was to me. Just didn't know how. No one ever taught me. So I continued to look
like
that.
Sometimes when you're in those tense situations, you may try to express yourself to the person you love, and they may not hear it.
Yeah.
Because of all the other noise between you.
100%. I never honored her. I never made it about her. So we are, we're struggling. Like, we're heading down the divorce path, and all of our other friends had gotten divorced, and we're like, okay, maybe this is it. And then I found this organization called Wake Up Warrior. And I remember scrolling Facebook and seeing an ad for this guy who talked about these married businessmen with families, that you could have it all. You could have a relationship with God. You could have success. You could have all that, but there was a gamified system to it. I cautiously, optimistically joined. And I played the game from the sidelines for about 2 years. So then I invest. And now the leader of this organization, Garrett J. White, he finds God. So the whole thing is moving that direction. Like, wait a minute, I didn't sign up for the God thing. Like, this, no, I wanted you to make my life and my business better, but I still was refusing to submit to the one that really mattered the most. So now they're all talking about this, this psychedelic experience journeys that they're all having. I'm in the military. I'm raised in a church where drugs are wrong. I never do any of this stuff, but I'm self-righteous and say, not me, not my God, not going to happen. And then I start watching this dramatic transformation of all of them. Like, they're surrendering and they're submitting and they're getting these conversations with God, this relationship thing that I didn't know existed, because people are so, they want to learn about God, but they don't want to experience it. So they're all experiencing. So I say to my wife, you know, I really think this is something we need to do. And I still hadn't told her that I was molested. So in our struggles, we're starting this couples journal called The Year of Us. If any of your listeners have ever really wanted to connect with somebody, The Year of Us is such a great journal. It's 365 days of questions that you ask each other. So we were videoing these, and it was really powerful because I was learning things about her that I never asked. Like, 23 years together, I never asked her about herself. So one year I decided I was going to go to Rachel University, and this was the year, and I was going to study and learn my wife for the first time. Well, the question came up 5 weeks later. What's the biggest thing that you've never told anyone? And just like that, I said, I was molested for 2 years. And she looked at me and she said, wait a minute, I've never heard this. I said, I've never told anyone. And just like that, the weight just came out. It was just like, I was finally able to breathe. And we started having conversations. So I told my parents. My parents were just like, blaming themselves. How didn't I know? How did, and that's a natural thing. So I started telling people about this, and they're like, well, I'm really sorry. I didn't know how to handle that for the longest time. Now I just say, yeah, it's not happening today. Like, by the grace of God, I'm like through all of that. But again, still not letting it go. I go to a Navy SEAL boot camp for elite leaders. And it's a very Christian boot camp. It's called Warrior Week. I have this incredible encounter with God. I'm reading the Bible for the first time really ever. I get baptized on the beaches of Dana Shore, and I leave all of that at a cross. Yet I come home and it's still there. Like, I still have just not let it go. So I'm driving down a street and I see a church, and God says, you need to go there. I'm like, nope, not doing that. Need to go there. Nope, not doing that. Third time. For me, it's kind of like
God. Back
at home. So then God tells me like three times. Like, I don't know why it's always three. He's just like, we know you're going to do it. Just do it the first time. So I went in. My wife was in Florida running a half marathon. I had my kids in the backseat. I said, hey, we're going to go there. It was Friday. We're going to go Sunday. And they're like, where? I'm like, I know, right? Like, we're going to church. They were 5 and 7. So we go in and they say, welcome home. And I busted out crying because it was the first time I felt like I had actually been home. Now, I have studied the Bible. I've gone to Bible college. I am a pastor. I am a businessman. So I think the logical thing, I talk a lot about biblical history and all of that stuff, but again, never experiencing God. Now all these pieces are kind of lining up and my friends are all going and having this amazing experience in psychedelics. I'm now in this church and I'm starting to feel God. Still not there yet. So I say to my wife, we're going to go to this place everyone else does, and we're just going to go together. Well, my wife had had a lot of things in her life and trauma growing up in her home as well. Very toxic Christian environment. Her family was from the foothills of Kentucky. Snake handling and all the fun stuff that goes with it. So we decide that we're going to go to a place in Nashville.
She's open to this idea?
Totally open. So grudgingly together going to do this. Now, I will say my wife is amazing that whether she understands or not, she supports me and trusts me. But I think maybe it was we're at the end of our rope here. Like, we're going to figure out something. So we go. There's a whole lead up process before. It's setting and integration. So why are you going? Meeting with our person, our guide. And I was deathly afraid. I was deathly afraid that we were going to come out of this and my wife wouldn't love me anymore, and that there were things that were going to come out of me. And I think she felt the same way. So together, we kind of go. And I was in one room. She was in the other. We record our transcripts and our journeys. So we go into the medicine. The very first thing that I see is a drop, and my wife and I are looking out over a large, lushy area. With a winding stream, and there's this beautiful garden, and I see this Aztec eagle. Again, I'm Mexican, but I see her and I standing on it. So then I'm immediately taken to a different place, and it's a door. And in that door, I'm sitting on the steps of my grandparents' house, where my abuser would tap my shoulder, and he would say, come upstairs. And I relived it. I relived the entire abuse. But at the end of it, I was actually sitting on the bed with him, and he was crying, and he was telling me that it was done to him. And then I was taken to another door. I saw a door when I was 4 years old. It was my mom and dad. They had a fight about money, and my dad had bounced a check. My mom had berated him and ripped him. I was 4. I don't remember the house, but I remember the room. I remember where I was. I remember where I was laying, and I remember my dad coming in crying. And I had to relive all of that. That's what defined everything I ever thought about success. I didn't want to be that. So I went the other way subconsciously from the time I was 4. So now I have another door. And the week after I am married, my wife and I are coming home, and we're having a very similar fight because we were just out of college. My 5-year-old son came to live with us. We had no money, and we had the same fight. Except that she ran upstairs to our rented house and she wanted me to hold her. She wanted me to tell her it was okay. And instead I threw a pillow at her and I said, I guess this is where you're sleeping tonight. And that was the foundation of our marriage. So God is showing me all of these things, and he's showing me the healing at the end of it. While we're doing that, we're building this 10,000 square foot home. Like, life is good. Like, there is a beam across our 25-foot great room that says Wiederhold underneath all the drywall. And I'm wondering if we're even going to stay together through this entire thing. And then God is showing me that this is a house that's going to become a home. I see my kids growing up. I see my oldest with his wife and my granddaughter, and we're outside and we're walking and we're holding hands. So all this healing is taking place. And I find my heart laying on the side of the road, and I pick it up, and it's blossoming. And God says, there's your heart. And I said, there's my heart. I haven't seen you in such a long time. And everything just kind of changed for me. So when I'm in the medicine, I'm hearing my wife. My wife is praying for me in the other room, and I'm hearing her in my journey. And I actually say so many times, when you breathe, I can move mountains. So I hear you. She was leaving me things to be able to find me through the journey. And then at the very end of this journey, it's about 3 hours, I see an image of an out-of-body, and I am looking down on my bed where I'm nesting. And anyone who has done psychedelics knows the nesting process. But this time God is standing over me with the lights, and he is showing me this image where I'm laying on the bed, and my wife is now covering me with her hands and feet like a canopy. And all this darkness had been barraging me for the last 25 years of our marriage, and she took all of it. She protected me from me. So they give us this opportunity to come back together. A lot of people don't, and a lot of people do. And they came in and they said, hey, your wife really wants to come back together. What do you think? I'm like, my God, yes. But just before I do, God shows me this image of her and I walking in the garden, free of ego, as it was intended in the very beginning. So here, she and I are walking with God. I go into her room, and for the next day, we're reconnecting. I met her soul for the very first time. And in her whole experience, she's healing and having conversations with her mom that was just like profoundly impacted her growing up and her need for love. So we rediscovered each other at that time. Well, imagine coming home and running a business, having these conversations. And I'm just like, okay, now what do I do with all of this? So I'm driving down the road. And it's about 5 weeks later, and God says to me in the car, you know what you need to do. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. And he's like, you know what you need to do? I'm like, I'm not doing it. And he's like, here we go again. And I'm like, God, I don't want to find my abuser. I don't. I did. I called him. I forgave him. And it went just like I saw in my journey. He deflected. He apologized. He said, I'm sorry. And then it happened to me. And I said, I know. And I said, this isn't about you. This is about me forgiving you. I have no idea where you are in your life. I haven't seen you in 45 years. I just want you to know that it's okay. I'm not going to do anything. I don't want to know anything about where you are. I'm not here to attack your family. I just need you to know that I can move forward now and that I forgive you. And that was it. I got off the phone. I'm like, I can pretty much do anything now. So...
Can that's I ask a little bit of questions there?
Oh, please.
I think I have about three questions. So the first group that you were a part of, the warrior, like business guy group.
Yep.
Did they move in a Christian direction, like simultaneously while embracing the psychedelics, or were the psychedelics already a part of it?
I will say Christianity first. I think that there were some things going on in his life where he was searching. Some things with his daughter that kind of led him to the psychedelic therapy. But then I think it all just kind of became one because it's a sacrament. And that was really kind of how he had illustrated it.
It's very interesting. Okay. And what about at the experience y'all had together? Was that what medicine was that?
So they don't tell you what it is. Only because I have done so much research and like anything. So I believe that it was ketamine. I believe that they open you with sassafras oil and something else, probably MDMA. But I know typically, you know, ketamine experience is like 45 minutes to maybe an hour tops. So I was in the medicine for about three and a half hours. And it was kind of crazy because I came out, I'm like, well, it was 10 years of therapy all done at one time. But I know that the experiences for many are not like that. It was a lot of things that had to come out.
Well, I know a lot of people I've never used MDMA. The next day, apparently people feel really drawn down. You know, like you need to rest a lot. Did you kind of have that feeling?
No, not at all. In fact, for like a day, we were together for a day and a half in a room with no lights, just candles, listening to the same journey music that we had. We were recorded the entire session of our whole time together. But
that's an incredible way to integrate an experience between. I mean, you had your separate experiences, but then to be able to come together, and you mentioned something about. You were fearful, like what the results might be.
Yeah.
I think especially And you're right to do so, because especially when people are in relational tension, especially for extended periods of time, you know, years on years of just conflict and inability to see eye to eye. And sometimes people can have a psychedelic experience and realize, like, hey, this ain't working. Like, we need to, like, let's just go our separate ways and start over. And that can be scary, like, if you know that's a possibility, because sometimes people, that's the conclusion they come to. They recognize that, or they're in their journey, they feel like they're told that this is not working and you need to go elsewhere.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting. So again, I like everything. I study everything. I've written a couple of books. So now, like, I feel like God's like, okay, now I need to write a book called Walking in the Garden with God, Discovering God Through Psychedelics. And so I started doing a lot of this research, and the journey that you get is not always the journey that you want. It's always the journey that you need. But I think that sometimes people can bring their own preconceived ideas into it. Like, and that's where I think that, like, I don't believe that God ever just says, leave your wife. I just don't. Like, and one thing my wife will always tell you, in all the problems that we ever had, love is a decision. It's an action. It is not an emotion. Every day I choose to renew my mind and love her. Now, what's really wild, and I will challenge anyone to do this. The very first thing I do when I wake up in the morning is I put my hand on her leg while she's sleeping and I pray over her. I pray for her day, because it doesn't matter how angry I might be, whatever happened the day before with her. When I just leave it there and I put my hand and I think about elevating her over me, I have a completely different outlook. Like, it's just like, it's different. So, so we go here. I do this massive forgiveness thing. I am now like, okay, now what do? I still have this business. I still love healthcare. I love insurance. I'm like, let's just start a podcast and talk about this. Because as a business owner, I suffered a lot with imposter syndrome. You know, we talked about my whole life of being an imposter of, am I gay? Am I this? Am I, I'm being molested? All these things defined who I was because I didn't have an identity. So now I started this podcast called The Cost of Doing Nothing. And it's really about two questions. For me, it's what does freedom look like for you? And it's different for everyone. And then the question of what do I have to become to be free? So, and that's the question that I'm constantly asking. I'm asking God, I'm asking friends, like, so for you to really be free, what does that look like? Because there's a cost to doing nothing. I mean, inaction is still something. So it's been a really fascinating journey on how this is all kind of tied together.
Yeah. I know you probably feel almost compelled to share all this, but it's a brave move. Whether you're choosing it or whether it's just coming out of you, regardless of your choice. And it's powerful on my end to witness a person like yourself just experiencing like this new freedom, to be honest about who you are, your experience. I mean, it's challenging in our society to be your true self and to share that true self with others. You almost need a powerful experience, like a life-threatening experience or a psychedelic experience or a salvation experience. It's like you need that kind of intercession into your life in order to give you the privilege, the opportunity to just reevaluate, you know, the way you've been living. And for the first time, sometimes you can see the masks you've been wearing. You can see all the times where you tried to make up for your insecurities by faking it or, you know, slapping some special sauce on your stories to make them sound better, to make you look more incredible. And
yeah,
it's so liberating to just experiencing not having that silly weight on your shoulders. And once you experience that kind of freedom from it, you don't want to go back to it. It's
almost like
liberating.
It's almost like, though, there's new levels, new devils. So yes, did I want to go this direction? I don't think not necessarily. This was not like the direction that I thought I was going to go. Like, yeah, I'm going to go and do this. Like, you know, we sold our company a couple of years ago, and You know, I'm like, I don't really know what I want to do. Like, I part of me is like, I'd love to stand on a stage. And I thought that's what I was supposed to do, you know, be like a pastor. So, and it's funny because I'm actually friends with several pastors in Baltimore. And one says, wait a second, like, you and I had this very early conversation about identity. I'm a plumber. Does that make me any more called than me as a businessman or a president of a bank? Or no, it doesn't. So we're all called. So he says to me, I believe there are three types of people. He says, I believe that there are the priests. That is me. That's the guy who's chose to do this as a profession. There are the prophets. There are those who have the message, who have to go out and share. And then there are the kings. There are the kings who fund the ministry and the priests. There's nothing wrong with being a king. So it's like you don't have to drop everything that you're doing to run to that. So, and I was walking away from that, I'm thinking, yeah, you know, you're right. Because when we hear the story of the rich man, and I love the story because he walked away grieving because the message was, are you willing to leave your comfort in your identity? It wasn't that wealth was wrong, because if you look at biblical history, wealth meant that you were in alignment with God. Like, that's what they believed. So it wasn't the fact that having money or success, it was, what do you do with it? Because we're all following something. What are you following? Is it money or is it the way? So now I'm at this crossroad of like, this is it, man. Like, I really don't even have a choice at this point. Like, I just feel like I've got to get my story out. And when I was at this boot camp, and I was able to start sharing the story of being molested, I had somebody who came to me and he said, what took you so long to tell my story? I was molested too. And I never had the courage to tell anyone until you did. I had six people tell me that in the last year.
That's the power of being honest right there. It gives everybody else the freedom to be honest too.
Yeah.
Because you won't take off your mask until you see somebody else doing it. It's that's why I take the first action in a new conversation, new relationship to reveal something potentially vulnerable. You know, it doesn't have to be big. But just a little, you got to extend vulnerability if you expect other people to be vulnerable with you, you know, because we've all kind of got our guard up. And once, you know, you share something that person can resonate with, you if you watch, you can almost see people go like, oh, he's like me, you know, and it becomes a more relaxed atmosphere.
Yeah.
And so the value of you sharing your experience is magnitudes greater than you can ever quantify, because those men are going to do the same thing in their own way. You know, they may not be as public about it as you are, but it'll give them the strength because they can see that strength in you.
So what's interesting about that, though, one of the things I found is that when you fight with yourself for such a long time and then you become free, the challenge with that is that you now start going to war against yourself. You start questioning what's peace look like. So in that, actually, I struggled with that for a couple of months after I came home from my journey. Things are great with my wife. Like, we're communicating, like, crazy stuff. Like, I thought authenticity. I'm like, wow, okay, this is kind of weird. Cause like, and then I was like, what am I supposed to do with my life? So then I go on another journey. And I'm now with myself. So I go into the medicine, psilocybin. I start researching everything there is to know about psilocybin in Maryland. I live close to DC where it's not criminalized. So I can literally call and have it delivered. So I'm now doing all this investigation. And I decide that I'm going to go in and have myself my own journey for a couple of days. I do a hero dose. So I set the date. Kids are going off to school. My wife owned a business, so she was getting ready to go off. And I do the exact same process. So I go through a couple of weeks where I'm really trying to decide, what is it I'm trying to get out of this? And then you and I were kind of talking before the show. So I start journaling, almost a prayer to God. Like, I just dump out everything that is me. Every fear, every thought, I'm struggling with peace. Like, I'm struggling with what I'm supposed to do with whatever this is. And then I go in and then I find that I have not had a chance to grieve that person. I healed him, but I didn't grieve him. And then God says, okay, great. That's done. Now let's bury him and have a funeral and move on. So I see this image. I'm actually standing on the road and I look back and my bags are back there. I'm no longer with my bags, but now I don't know what to do because my arms are free. I've carried those bags for so long. So we had a funeral. Like I literally saw myself laying and we put him in the ground. And then God says, let the dead bury their dead. It's time to move on. And just like that, it was like, okay. So I think that's where things kind of, it was a turning point. Like there was a fire that came in and then I'm having this conversation with my wife and my wife says, you know, I got a lot out of mine, but I really didn't think I got a lot. And I'm like, okay, awesome. Let me help you. So we go through the whole setting and intentions. I create the playlist. And then I watched her go to war with her soul for about 6 hours of fighting back and forth. And I kept upping the dose. Like she was just like resistant. So finally just submitted. And I'm watching this beauty of just the child, the magic, and everything that she would not allow herself to feel. And there's a reason Jesus says, come to me as a child, because the rest of what we have in our heads as egos is what really separates us from God. So free of all that, I'm watching this and it is literally the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And I share this with some friends and then I have friends coming to me and saying, hey, I need that. Can you do that for me too? And like, we'll rent a hotel room with the Four Seasons and I'll go into a room and I'm out in the living room and I walk them through this whole process. And then there's a part of where I purposely have a dark side, and you know, with psychedelics, with music, it's up and it's down and we're really grabbing the emotions. Well, I know that there's a part and I hear one of my friends struggling. Like I hear it gets super quiet. So then I put my hand on his heart and I open up his headphone and I say, God wanted me to tell you that darkness is where infinite possibilities reside. Just like that. Put the headphone back on and I watched him just shoot. And at the end of his journey, he's like, Weed, are you still here? And I'm like, where am I going to go? Like, you know, like, and he goes, that was, I have complete clarity on what it is I'm supposed to be doing. I'm in, let's go. So, and I have watched him literally take that. And now he does it on his own with the exact same protocol and the same format that I have kind of taught. So with the setting music, recording it, transcribing it, and taking that with you. So then we're just kind of got around with some other friends. So this is kind of in my part-time, I've been working through this. I got clinically certified to be able to do this so that I wasn't just some crazy person on the street, just like putting people through this process. So I started to understand clinically that side of it. But you're right. People need an experience to be able to let go of their ego to see what is real. Because all of this, none of this is real. This is all a frame of mind, a historical reference in our brain that is somewhere that's trying to keep us grounded into something.
I agree. So you had this, you know, healing journey, you and your wife, but you have this adult son. How did you, like, is there a mending process there and reconnecting with him?
So he would call, we would have these Bible conversations. Remember, he went to Bible college. And I would talk, but we still weren't father and sons. I was still trying to figure it all out. And then 2 years ago, we went to a Wake Up Warrior. Again, I'm still part of Warrior. I'm now a little bit more integrated into it. We go to this thing called Warrior Con 4. And I invite my son. So I pay for him to come to Vegas. He and I were supposed to go at the same time. It was crazy because God's actually like, you know what? Let him go first. You stay back. I had some meetings that day. And then I get these text messages. He's on the stage. Like, he's on the stage with Garrett. And I still have no idea what he's saying. I have no idea what's going on. And he's talking about how he didn't have a dad, but that he found God in the middle of all of this. So then I get there and he says, Dad, I didn't know men talk like this. So free and so vulnerable and so willing to share their crap and just... we stayed up till 1:30 in the morning. I just landed and it's 2.5 hours behind and I'm exhausted, yet we're having this conversation, but yet we still don't talk about the past. Like we just didn't, like we just shuttle it under. I didn't think I did the same thing with my dad. So a day later, like we're in these breakout sessions and someone comes to me and his name was Brian Quinn. And he says, "Hey, your son needs to see you." I'm like, "Okay, I'm in the breakout. I'm Alan way up here in the warrior movement." And then he goes, "No, he really needs to see you." I'm like, "Can it wait?" And he's like, "No, it cannot wait." So my son's outside crying. And this is what all comes to a head. And he said, "You were never there for me." Let it all out. All of his anger, everything. And all I could do was take a knee. And I took a knee and I stood back up and I said, "You don't think I ever knew what you were doing? We knew the entire time and it broke our heart. We waited every day for the police to call for you to be dead. We did not know how to save you because I couldn't save myself. My dad used to tell me when I was growing up, you represent me when you leave this house." He never told me who he was. Most dads don't, because they don't know. So it just repeats itself. So I stood up and I said, "If you think for 1 minute that I never cared, I am so sorry." And we made amends that second outside of WarriorCon 4, nobody there. No one knew what was going on. But he and I, after 32 years, that was the 8th year of his clean and sober that day. And that WarriorCon 4 was called Free Man. That's what the event was called. So it was just insane how now my son is, he lives in Michigan. He's building a business. He's gotten married to a girl he met in Bible college. They have a beautiful girl. She's going to be one. Our granddaughter will be one. They were just here for Christmas, but he calls now for advice and for prayer. Never thought I'd see that coming, ever. My kids, my 7 and 9 year olds, who love their brother more than anything, we call every week. When they get sick, when they're hurt, my belly aches, "Dad, will you pray for me?" Never saw that coming. That wasn't what I experienced growing up. But my kids see a side of God that is the experience, not the education and the learning.
Yeah, I think we need both, but I think all modern Western Protestantism has given us, well, and Catholicism too, is this rigid list of do's and don'ts. We talk about love. It's all rules and laws and do's and don'ts. And I'm not saying those things are bad. I'm just saying they're horrifically unbalanced. Yeah. With the love that we should have with God and with each other.
So, and I think where the confusion comes, and I agree, and I think what's so funny about Catholics is they say, "I'm a Catholic or a practicing Catholic." And I feel like Christians should almost say the same thing. I'm a Christian or I'm a practicing Christian. But really, what is that term? You know, we kind of talked about this in the beginning, and this is where, you know, Jesus says, "Follow me." And then what did they refer to it as? The way. Like, it wasn't like, if you were in the early church and they said to you, "Hey, where do you guys worship?" "We don't have a temple." Well, who was your religious leader? "Well, he died. He's there." "Wait a minute. You don't have a building. You don't have a priest. Like, what are you? Like, you're like atheists." So we have somehow lost the intent of the way. And that's what we're supposed to be sharing. We're supposed to be disciples of Jesus as the rabbi and the disciple. You know, so I'm in a Bible class right now. It's kind of funny. My church has like these Bible college classes, and I was just interested and I got enrolled. And I'm like, "All right, let's roll." So we're in the Gospels right now, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. And we just finished Mark, and now I'm into Matthew. And it's so fascinating when you read like why they wrote what they wrote. So, and there's so much other stuff going on that I think as Christians, we miss all of it. Like we miss so much of the little things because it's lost in translation, or we don't have a word for it now, but they did back then. So, you know, so my wife and I now, she's reading Genesis, and we sit in our bedroom every night and she's like asking questions. And I'm like, "Oh yeah, well, this is what that means." And talking about the covenant that God made with Abraham and how coolly profound that was. And Yeah, I mean, it's just like, so I think that we continue, even as Christians, to put God in this box because it's just easier for us to understand.
Yeah, and I like the way you say that. You say it's the way. It's not the destination. It's not the journey. It's not the, you know, you haven't arrived. Once you become a disciple of Christ, you're not, that's where the journey, the way begins. That's mm-hmm. not the destination.
Yeah.
And oftentimes that's, in a way, it's kind of like, especially in kind of modern American Protestantism, we're taught that. Like, if you just get here, just get to the church, say the prayer, bingo.
Yes.
Now just keep showing up. You know,
it's fire like, insurance. Fire insurance.
Yeah. There's more to it. You know, there's a relationship being built, you know, yeah. And in order to have a relationship with Jesus Christ, you have to be vulnerable and you have to submit to the discipline of the rabbi, which is what you're saying. That we forget all that. You know, you have the good fortune of having been to Bible college.
Yeah.
Even though that may have mixed blessings for you particularly in your personal experience. But so many of us Christians don't have that intense educational experience in learning the subtleties of the biblical, you know, narrative. You know, you're speaking about Abraham. One story that always pops up in my mind when we talk about Abraham is when God makes the covenant with him in the wilderness. And people always ask, why are they cutting these animals and walking through and all, you know, and it's because we haven't been taught about the culture of that time and what it meant to take oaths and why these animals were separated and all these things. But that kind of stuff is just saturated through the whole Bible. Mm-hmm. And we're reading it from a modern context and imposing our own culture and our own values on top of people that had practices that were so far removed from our own experiences that we don't even understand why they were doing it.
I always say, you know, it's very difficult to read the Bible as a 21st century oppressor when the book was actually written by the oppressed. I mean, look at the people who wrote it. First, it was orally translated around a campfire for hundreds of years. I don't think the first book of the Bible was actually written for 300 years. And they were actually in captivity in Babylon. So you always have to ask the question, who said what and why did they say it? And we don't do that enough. I think a lot of times what I see, and I think it robs people of joy, is they'll take a verse out of context without having any understanding of what was actually going on and what is that referring to and what was just the enormity. I mean, if you just take the baptism scene in Mark 1 and the reference, so for a person to be a rabbi, they usually started their ministry at the age of 30 to be a rabbi. So now, to be a rabbi, you had to follow another rabbi. You had to subscribe to his yoke. So when Jesus says, my yoke is light, I always ask everyone, what does that mean? They're like, well, the ox thing. I'm like, actually, it doesn't. The rabbi's yoke is with his interpretation of the Torah. So that was his. You had a rabbi Shmuel. You had a rabbi Hamal. They all had their interpretations, and other rabbis would always refer to that rabbi. Well, when they said Jesus spoke with authority, did you ever hear him quoting another rabbi? No, he quoted the scripture. That's where his authority came from. So when you look at the baptism and you look at who was there, so John was a witness, the Holy Spirit was a witness, and so was God. There were the three that you needed to give authority to a rabbi to start his ministry. But it's deeper than that, because you now have God the Father, you have the Word, which John says was Jesus, and then you have the Holy Spirit fluttering like a dove. That was a reference back to Genesis 1. So when the dove floated over the waters free of shape and void. So there's all this like amazingly cool stuff going on in one verse. But somehow we rob ourselves of all of this joy to quote this other thing that supports what our belief is instead of what the way is. So, and it's mind-boggling to me. Even like, you know, I was talking to somebody, they were saying, when Jesus is on the cross and he's saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? How small is a God that forsakes? That is not the God in the Bible who made that covenant with Abraham. Could it be that Jesus was actually quoting Psalm 22 when David says, my God, why have you forsaken me? every lamentation starts off like that, but what's the ending? You are delivering me from my enemies. You're doing all this other amazing stuff. You're walking me through the pit into what we call shift and drift. So could it be bigger than that? Could God really be bigger than just forsaking Jesus because he had sin? Or was he just one more slap in the face to the religious leaders on his way out the door?
That's powerful. So you've got this education. So that makes you a prime candidate to just get rid of all this business stuff and be a preacher. But you said earlier, we have different roles, you know? And So are you viewing your future more in that kingship provision type of role? And
I am. So I have kind of walked that. Do I leave it all and start something else? And God tells me no. My role is to have a larger stage. So I am in a very successful company today. It's amazing. But during that time, as I was building this house, God is saying I needed to have a Bible study for men. And I'm like, man, Bible studies are douchey. Like they're so horrible. They're like, oh, Hercules. And I, 3 weeks ago, I'm having this war with God because he's like, all right, where's the Bible study? I'm like, well, you know, we have the holidays. We just moved into this house in October and January. And he's like, yeah, that's all great. And then I was like, well, I really can't find one that I like. And he's like, well, then create one. You've written 2 books. So when is this going to happen? So I said this to my wife. I came out of my room like, God says I have to write a Bible study. And she was like, what? And she's laughing. She's like, all right, put your money where your mouth is. So I'm like, so I have a passion to lead men and do it in a biblical foundation that is not douchey. So I'm working on it right now. So what's that?
We need more of that.
Yeah. So I have my first 4 weeks done. I don't know how long it's going to go. I'm envisioning probably no more than 3 months because I think I can drag something else out. But then I started to create a 365-day devotion for men just on what the philosophies of what we have in Wake Up Warrior, which is body, being, balance, and business. We are four-dimensional creatures that are defined by our body as the temple, our relationship with God, our relationships with our families, and then what our business is. Whether that be an employee or working for yourself, it's all the same in representing the kingdom. So that's kind of what I'm doing. And then you and I got introduced because another company that is bringing ketamine-assisted therapy into employer workspace came to me for advice. So I started guiding them on how to bring that into the employer space, which is the space that I work in, which turned into God telling me that I needed to go to my club, my country club that you and I were talking about, and join the VA committee. So as a veteran, I have taken but never given. So I'm on the veterans committee. They were looking for topics. And I said, well, let's talk about ketamine assisted therapy and PTSD for vets. And they were open to it. So I am bringing psychedelic therapy into Baltimore, into the Baltimore club, not the club scene, but the other kind of club. I'm excited to see where God is taking me. And at this point, I'm along for the ride because I really have no idea where it's going.
Well, I'm thankful for that. And ketamine is a particularly, I guess, easy thing to introduce because it already has medical applications, mm-hmm. and it's
FDA ubiquitous. Approved.
Yeah, FDA approved, and there's more studies being done. So that I feel like I walk this fine line because I see the value that psychedelics can provide people, and particularly and possibly even especially Christian people in some cases. But we have to do that, I think, with respect and discernment and wisdom. I'm not excited about mushroom chocolate bars flying off the shelves and things like that. I'm not against it. I really want people to be educated, and I want people to take the time and intention necessary to have an experience that improves your relationships with your fellow humans and with the creator, and one that doesn't leave you fearful, despondent, wrecked. Unfortunately, in the wrong context, people can have very negative experiences, mm-hmm. and they can have very negative results in their life, you know, post psychedelic experience, if not integrated properly. And so I
agree.
Think
community. I so agree. And you and I were talking, it's almost a slippery slope. And I agree 100%. I think if it's used as a sacrament, and your intention is to connect closer to God, fellow man, whatever that be, to follow the way, then I think it has some prime application. But then I think there comes a point where you have to ask yourself, why are you doing it? And I'm kind of on that road right now of listening to the story of the woman that had the blood issues. When she heard Jesus could heal her, what did she do? She touched his robe. So it was superstition. So she believed that if she just touched it, she could heal. But what did he say? Who touched me? So he made her give a profession of faith. And she was afraid, because to touch a rabbi, to be unclean, had massive implications for this woman. But he made her tell her story. So it took it from superstition to, what did he say? Your faith has made you heal. Not my tassels, not my robe, your faith. So you have to get to a point where it moves beyond superstition to relationship with God, because it's not the medicine. It's the soul that's bringing it out. And we can spend another 5 hours talking about the pineal gland and how we activate and the serotonin level opens. And to me, your pineal gland is the receiver that you have, like a TV antenna to God. And again, we can have an entire conversation on the science side of all of that. But I think that's what people are missing, is you come into anything with ego. And you start becoming more aware without in the medicine. You just become more aware. Like, there is something beyond, and we talk about this. What we see is not real. Every thought that you have, the average person has 60 to 70,000 thoughts a day. They start at 9, they end at 30. Every decision that you make, 95% of them are already going to happen. You have zero control over it. That's how your brain works. It's for fight, flight, or freeze. And I teach my kids this. So do what scares you, because your brain is already trying to protect you. So today, our dinosaurs, our woolly mammoths, and our saber-toothed tigers are conversations with our wives, or an argument with our boss, or a coworker, and then we have this anxiety that we bring to it, and it just magnifies. So the medicine just teaches you that none of this is real, and that you have to reformat your way of thinking to be able to kind of rewire your brain.
Yeah. Or it may be, oftentimes I tell people, your experience is real, but you're only witnessing like 5% of it. There's this whole spectrum of vision, sound, wavelengths, and we're only experiencing a narrow part of it. And for whatever reason, somehow psychedelics give you the opportunity to experience at least envision that as a possibility, to begin to get your mind around our human experience, and the words we use to describe God are not inaccurate necessarily. They're just woefully impotent.
They're just not big enough. The average follower of Jesus is neutered. We have no power. We don't, because we don't truly believe or surrender. So to me, again, going back to my original journey when we were walking in the garden, I mean, if you read the story, they had a relationship. They were walking and talking together with God. And what happened when they ate the fruit? Their ego immediately became about me. I was naked and afraid, so I hid. That's what we're all doing today. We're hiding because we have ego.
Well, brother, I know that we don't have a lot of time. You got some family obligations to tend to today. So take a few minutes to tell people about your books and your podcasts and where they can find you, where they connect with you, and follow what you're doing.
So I have a podcast called The Cost of Doing Nothing, where we talk every day, every week about imposter syndrome and ask ourselves the question. There is a cost to doing nothing. What does it mean to be free? So that's the journey that I'm on right now. You can contact me at alan@costofdoingnothing.us. And I have written some books on healthcare. As I said before, I'm now writing a book about psychedelics and Christianity. I just felt like that was something that God was calling me to do. I've had a lot of support from a lot of friends in doing this. And hopefully in the next 2 weeks, Clint, I'll be able to share with you the Bible study that I have created called Awakened. So it is something that I'm super excited about hosting here in my home, as well as doing it virtually online at the same time.
Awesome. I was going to ask that, you know, because I think I have an inclination that what you're doing is going to be good and powerful. And I think others will want to participate, maybe at a distance, even if they can't be, you know, local. So
perfect.
I hope it just takes off like a wildfire, brother.
I as I said before, I'm on a ride. So wherever God
all
is
for, leading, all for God's glory.
It's wherever God is leading me right now is kind of where I'm at. I mean, it's amazing when you let go and you truly surrender. We always have a saying in Warrior, you know, the most powerful person in the room is the one with no secrets. Because if you can truly allow yourself to just love with no expectations of anything in return, and if we were all to follow that rabbi, none of the issues that we have today would really be that big of a deal.
That says a lot, but do you have anything else to leave with the listeners before we
go? I don't. Thank you so much for this. This actually was the first time that I have been on another podcast other than my own. So I really appreciate it. It was very exciting to be, and I'm glad that you and I got to connect, and I'm super excited to get to know you more.
Me too, Alan. I'm really, for what it's worth, I'm really proud of you for standing up and testifying to your experience. And I think it's going to help a lot of people.
And I appreciate that.
And I've been honored to have you here today. And I think my listeners will love your story. And I have no doubt that they'll want to check out your podcast. I'm going to send them that way. I've enjoyed it.
Perfect.
Brother, I'm going to let you get back to your busy day. And we'll have a minute here after we let the listeners go to debrief for a second. But I wish you grace and peace and every blessing upon you and your family.
Love it. Light and love. I'm praying for you, Clint. I told you that last week. So keep doing what you're doing, brother. It's phenomenal.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Well, my friends, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Alan as much as I did. If you have any questions or comments for us, reach out to us on LinkedIn. This episode should appear as a recent post on my profile. Check for it there and feel free to post your comments. As promised, I have a podcast recommendation for you and some information concerning the University of Pittsburgh Psychedelic Study. My podcast recommendation today is actually a YouTube channel instead of a traditional audio podcast, so you might want to watch these. The views of the locations really add to the conversation. The channel is simply the name of its creator, Matt Whitman. So I endorse this channel with one caveat. There is quite a bit of content on Matt's channel, and I have only viewed the videos that involve him visiting a wide variety of Christian churches and discussing the aspects of that church and its tradition with the clergy of that church. Concerning these videos on his channel, I can absolutely endorse without reservation. It is so refreshing to hear other Christians describe their tradition without judgment or objection, just letting them tell the story. Matt does a fantastic job of asking insightful questions that most all of us have about all these various churches we pass everywhere we go, yet we've never had the time or the inclination to further investigate. I think his channel can be a real means of grace for those new to or returning to Christianity and trying to get an idea of what Christian tradition they might live out their faith in. I currently live out my Christian faith as a member of my local Episcopal church. I have added a link in the show notes to a video from the Matt Whitman channel in which he visits a very historic and interesting Episcopal church in Florida. I think it's helpful for those of you who would like to better understand my tradition because the priest spends a lot of time explaining the architecture of the building. Episcopal churches, regardless of their size, tend to share some common elements. These architectural details are not simply pleasing to the eye. They tell stories. These buildings preach silent sermons, but these sermons are often unobserved by newcomers because our minds are trained to focus on the sermons written, sung, or spoken, not sermons woven into the fabric of our surroundings. So check the link to this video in the show notes. Now, without further delay, let's discuss this psychedelic research study that any of you, theoretically, can participate in. The purpose of the University of Pittsburgh research study is to learn the variety of ways a person might have a psychedelic experience that reminds them of something in Christianity, whether or not the person is Christian. They simply ask you to complete an online survey that should take about 15 to 30 minutes. The survey does not require that you provide identifiable information, but you can choose to provide contact information if you are willing to be contacted for follow-up questions. You will find a link directly to the survey in the show notes of this episode on thepsychedelicchristianpodcast.com. And as I mentioned earlier, I am planning to host one of the study administrators for a conversation later in May of 2024. But don't wait till then. If you would like to participate in the study, please do so as soon as possible. I myself already have. And remember, you can find the link in the show notes. Well, my friends, we've once again enjoyed our time here at this little pub, sitting at the crossroads of Christian faith and psychedelics. I wish you Godspeed on your journey. And until we meet again, may the Lord bless you and keep you.